Aloha. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation. It's Monday, July 20th. I'm Robbie Dingman, in for Catherine Cruz. A Japanese energy company is looking to expand its operations on Oahu. We get reactions to a possible second electric utility keeping the lights on. We hear from the new executive director of the Honolulu Ethics Commission about the watchdog role. She's a familiar face in good government efforts, what she wants the public to know about keeping city dealings ethical. We take stock of RIMPAC, midway through the war games. What does the latest technology, from AI to drones, mean for global sea fighters? And we sit down with a longtime owner of Irish pubs on Oahu. There's a changing of the guard in the dive bar scene.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Robbie Dingman. The Japanese energy company JIRA has proposed creating a new public utility to supply power to Oahu. That means there could be two electric utilities responsible for keeping the lights on. HPR's climate reporter Savannah Harriman-Pote joins us live to explain what this means for customers and the energy landscape. Thanks for joining us. Please help us understand how this will affect the islands.
Good morning. Yes, glad to. So JIRA announced this move on Friday in a letter to the Public Utilities Commission. And in that letter, JIRA said it wants to form a new power generation company called GenCo, and that would be regulated as its own public utility. And so GenCo would then build a 500-megawatt power plant that would burn natural gas and use that to supply electricity to Oahu. If GenCo became a new utility, tasked with part of Oahu's electric service, it would be a really huge shakeup, right? For decades, Hawaiian Electric has been the only electric utility for not just Oahu, but 95% of customers in the state.
Yeah, everybody but Kauai. So is JIRA trying to replace Hawaiian Electric?
That is a great question. In their letter, JIRA said that it did not want to replace Hawaiian Electric as a retail electric utility. So every island has its own grid, a little grid 101. There's three components: generation, where the power comes from, be it a power plant or a solar farm; transmission, the lines that move electricity throughout the islands; and then distribution, how that electricity gets into homes. And so JIRA's saying Hawaiian Electric would still be running the grid, doing transmission, and providing customer service and doing distribution. I spoke with Hawaiian Electric CEO Scott Sue on Friday about how he thinks that would work.
This has not been done before in the United States. It's certainly not been done here in Hawaii. And there's a lot of pretty complicated questions that would need to be looked at. When they say that they don't see themselves as displacing Hawaiian Electric's role as the retail utility provider for customers, and in the context of what they've been putting forward, though, to create themselves as a new utility, GenCo, and to be the wholesale provider of generation, all that means to me is, okay, we will, Hawaiian Electric, we will continue to be the ones sending the bills out to customers. It's just that we will no longer be controlling the generation piece. So we will essentially be passing through what the GenCo is providing. So Hawaiian Electric bills would still be in your mailbox, but standing behind that bill would be the GenCo.
So why is JIRA taking this step?
I spoke with JIRA America's Vice President Eric Montag on Friday as well. And so JIRA is a Japanese company, and in fact, it's the largest power generation company in Japan. And there it sells power, it produces wholesale to other utilities that then sell it on to customers. So this isn't an unprecedented idea for them, but Montag said this is the first time the company would take this approach to the United States. And JERA has a target commercial operations date of 2030 for its gas plant. And they said that they determined that this route would be the fastest way to get that plant online.
And how long might all of this take?
That's a great question. So what JERA filed on Friday was a notice of intent, basically saying we plan on doing this. They still have to file an actual application for something called a Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity, which in Hawaii recognizes an entity as a regulated utility. And they're hoping to do that by early 2027, and then they're budgeting another 2 years for the PUC to review their application. So 2030 on paper is feasible, assuming that process goes as planned and everything surrounding that process goes as planned. But it's hard to say exactly how long it will take because the Public Utilities Commission, while it issues these certificates all the time to motor carriers and less frequently to water companies, it's been a long time since they've issued one for an electric utility. KIUC on Kauai, our newest electric service, they just transferred this certificate. So it's been truly decades since we've seen this type of process. The other thing that is true about JERA taking this route is that it will be able to make its case about its gas plant to the Public Utilities Commission without having to go through Hawaiian Electric, which could be really advantageous for JERA. So for a number of years, Hawaiian Electric has had a competitive bidding process in place, which is overseen by the commission. And that means that an energy developer can't just build a new project. They have to wait for HECO to put out a bid, and then they submit a proposal, and then they get selected, and then they agree to a contract with HECO, all of which needs to be approved by the commission. And JERA has been transparent that they don't want to do that. They don't think that their project needs to be compared to others, given how specific it is. And so in recent years, the only way for a project to bypass the competitive bidding process is if Hawaiian Electric asked the commission for a waiver on the project's behalf. So many, including myself, have been watching Hawaiian Electric and JERA really closely over the last couple of months to see if they would come to some sort of deal. Governor Green, even, who's a proponent of JERA, announced on The Conversation that he was expecting the two entities to strike a deal sometime in June, but that never materialized. And JERA declined to discuss any specifics of its negotiations with HECO, as did Hawaiian Electric. Montad did say for the record that JERA isn't taking this step just to get around having to make a deal with HECO.
You know, it could be perceived that way, but I think that, you know, this is certainly doing this under this form for a project of this scale has been in the works with us for some time, kind of regardless of how the HECO-JERA cooperation plays out.
What does HECO say about their conversations with JERA?
They also declined to offer specifics about what has been discussed, but it seems that any negotiations they've had have stalled. So Scott Sue told me that conversations were not ongoing at this time, but that Hawaiian Electric would be open to considering JERA's project as part of a future round of competitive bids.
You know, we really did spend some time trying to understand JERA's proposal and really try to explore how we might be able to, you know, as a state, take advantage of what JERA has to bring to the table, right? They are a large company. They've got lots of resources. Based in Japan, they do work all across the globe. The scale of this company is massive compared to ours. On the LNG piece, right, they are plugged into global conversations between Japan and President Trump's administration. So, you know, it's not lost on us that these guys are big players. And, you know, what the governor has really been trying to do is, how do we capitalize on what they can bring to Hawaii? And we understand that, and we support that objective. It's just in the details of how do we, Hawaiian Electric, you know, our relatively small company that's been serving Hawaii for over 130 years, how do we partner and see them as true partners with us? And that's where we've run into these issues. Not to say that we won't ever figure them out, and we hope to be able to, you know, get to that endpoint that I described earlier. It's just that is the challenge that's in front of us.
Savannah, if you could just briefly talk about what the most optimistic timeline would be, because to have LNG, there'd have to be a gas infrastructure.
Right. And so That 2030 date is still something that Eric Montag said he thinks is feasible. They intend to do things concurrently, right? So they've also approached the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to permit the part of their infrastructure that would be offshore on Oahu. They're going to be approaching other permitting entities. But there's a lot of skepticism that that 2030 date is realistic, just given, regardless of JIRA, the pace of projects in Hawaii.
Yes, permitting has never been the speediest of processes anywhere we go along. Thanks, Savannah. We appreciate you telling us more about this.
Thank you, Ravi. Take care.
You too. We've been hearing from HPR's climate and energy reporter, Savannah Harriman-Pote. Find her coverage on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Anchor Systems Hawaii.
This July, experience HPR's Live from the Atherton Classical Concert Series. On July 18th, violist Yuri Hughes joins pianist Jasmine Nagano for an intimate recital. Then on July 25th, vocalist Kaylin Howard and pianist Brian Bathia take the stage for an evening of classical song and piano. Get your tickets now at hprtickets.org. This event is sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from the State Office of Elections, reminding eligible residents to register, confirm, or update mailing addresses for the August 8th primary election. More at elections.hawaii.gov.
The Honolulu Ethics Commission last month appointed attorney Sandy Ma as its executive director and legal counsel in charge of enforcing ethics laws. Ma's name may sound familiar from her decades in legal, policy, and nonprofit work, and as a leader of Common Cause Hawaii. We spoke with Ma this morning, as ethical questions about our elected officials have been circulating at local and national levels. The state attorney general's office is still at work on its public corruption investigation over alleged bribes. Ma starts by explaining what her office does.
So the Honolulu Ethics Commission is different from the Hawaii State Ethics Commission. We are governed by a 7-member ethics commission, and we cover the city and county of Honolulu, all boards and commission members, all elected officials, and all people who work for the city and county of Honolulu. We make sure that people who are public servants in the city and county of Honolulu adhere to the highest ethical standards.
And how do you help to work to help them maintain that integrity?
So there are strong ethics laws in the city and county of Honolulu and the revised charter of Honolulu, and we enforce the charter, the Honolulu ordinance. We have rules of procedure. We have our own advisory opinions, and we guide the boards and commission members, the elected officials, and public servants regarding ethics standards.
So broadly, maybe it would be helpful to have some examples. So that would be other jobs that people could have, conflicts of interest. Like maybe talk a little bit about some of the more common types of things that come before the commission.
Yes. So some advice that we give to people, guidance that we give to people are surrounding gifts, conflicts of interest, disclosure of conflicts of interest, financial disclosures that people have to file, misuse of city resources, misuse of their positions that they hold in city government, post city employment, outside of city employment if they are employed by the city, and preferential treatment. Those are some categories that ethics covers.
And as the executive director and the legal counsel, what's your role in investigating complaints from the public?
So you can file a complaint with our agency. You could do it anonymously. While we ask you to submit some information, you don't have to provide your name. We do ask you to sign the form, but you could sign it with an alias, just so that the information can be, that you state that you verify the information submitted. Then we will take it and see if we have jurisdiction regarding the information, because sometimes people will think that it is a city and county issue, but it is a state issue, or it could be a federal issue. So we will do an investigation. We also have the right to staff initiate a claim. So if there's something that we see that we think this is a Honolulu Ethics Commission issue, we could staff initiate. We do not have to wait for someone to file a claim with us or a complaint with us.
Is that usually a mix then of staff initiated and public complaints?
It depends. Some years the public will file, or an agency or a fellow city employee, and some times we will initiate ourselves. We also have attorneys of the day where people will call and just ask us, is this something that we should can or cannot do? They want to remain ethical, and they will call and say, gee, can we accept this gift? Is this something possible? Or they will ask, should we file a conflict of interest form and seek an advice?
And that's something that's a big part of what you do, probably?
Yes, it is a big part of what we do. We have attorneys of the day that's staffed every single day.
Is the office fully staffed now? I know in previous years it was not.
Our office is not fully staffed at this point in time. We are looking forward to hiring two staff members.
So you have 9 of 11, is that correct?
Yes.
Great. And I was looking through the records and the resources and online, and the number of cases being investigated has risen and fallen in recent years. There was a high of 160 cases reviewed in fiscal year 22. And that dropped to 81 and then to 72 for the last fiscal year I could find online. What do you make of the ups and downs of that?
You know, we do a lot of training, I think, and it all depends. We do a lot of requests for advice. I think some of those numbers you mentioned were during pandemic years, and I think that may have affected the filing, and so that may have, like I said, affected them filing and may affected how people worked. And so I think that could have been a reason. As we've gone out of pandemic years, we've increased our trainings. We have a training specialist on staff who've retooled our online trainings regarding lobbyists, regarding conflicts of interest, regarding gift laws. We've had 100% of people trained within the city government who work for the city, 100% trained boards and commissions. And so people are more aware as we've come out of pandemic years regarding their ethical responsibilities and duties. And so that may have increased our filings as we've come out of pandemic years. That doesn't mean that people are less ethical or more ethical. It just means that people are more aware of their responsibilities. And that's a good thing. That really is. And we've gotten more requests for advice through our attorneys of the day call line. And so we're really proud of that and what our attorneys are handling.
Tell us a little bit about the stronger gift law that was passed in 2024.
So the gift law, we are currently educating both the public and city employees and elected officials and boards and commissions about what the gift law means. It really is about gifts of aloha and making sure that you don't take any gifts that could be viewed by the public as swaying your decision-making. So things over $25 or things, then you should not really take any gifts or meals.
And this would be in the case of somebody who, like, I go to a city agency and they really go out of their way to help me. And then I bake, so I make them awesome banana bread and I bring it in. whereas I don't bring in a $350
correct
gift basket.
Correct. Yes. You clearly have been trained on our gifts law.
But talk a little bit about why that was important, the gifts of aloha part of it, because I don't think a lot of other states or counties have gifts of aloha in their purpose of their law.
Well, I mean, it's important because, you know, Hawaii is such a state where aloha is so prevalent, and we want to share our appreciation for what we do, especially for our public workers who often do not get appreciated as much as they should. And so around the holidays or special occasions, we sometimes share aloha a little too much, and it could be viewed as a currying favor. And while that is not the intent, it may seem like that, and we want to make sure that everyone is treated equally and not provided unfair treatment. While that is not the intent, and while our workers will not provide unfair treatment or unequal treatment, this just makes it so that people are not tempted to create that unfair impression or unequal impression. And that's all it is.
While still allowing some aloha, but not overdoing it.
Over exuberant aloha.
We've been hearing from Honolulu Ethics Commission Executive Director Sandy Ma. Ma started in the role last month. We'll have more from our conversation after a quick break.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA, celebrating nearly 90 years of dedication in supporting the health and well-being of the people of Hawaii with a commitment to caring for the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
Aloha, this is Derek Malama. Please join me for the next episode of Kanikapila Vintage, the new podcast from HPR featuring classic editions of Kanikapila Sunday. This week, we go back to Natalie Aikomau. She talks about her journey from Miss Aloha Hula to a career as an award-winning musician. It's available this Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts. Sponsored by Manu Healii.
Support for HPR comes from Chamber Music Hawaii. Its 2026-27 season, Portals, opens the door to 10 worlds of music in 10 concerts. Subscriptions at chambermusichawaii.org.
Let's get back to our conversation with attorney Sandy Ma. She was recently named executive director of the Honolulu Ethics Commission. We asked her why the watchdog role is so important.
It is so critically important because in a functional democracy, ethics and trust in government is critical. Ethics and trust in government is the cornerstone of a working democracy. And this is why this agency is critical. And really, that is the bottom line. Without trust in government, government fails. And so that's why we all need ethics. Ethics is all of our kuleana. It's just not people who work in government. It is everyone.
And certainly the tumultuous social climate has amplified the importance and sometimes shaken people's faith in government.
Yes.
So I think it makes it even more important. And I think people are looking more for guidance a lot of the time.
Correct. And a lot of our work is not flashy work. It is just answering attorneys of the day. It is doing investigations. Sometimes we don't have hearings and publicize. Sometimes we could resolve things without, like I said, a public hearing. But that doesn't mean we're not doing the work. It doesn't mean that the staff is not working extraordinarily hard while being understaffed. But we are working. We are educating the public. We are educating public servants as to what it means to do the ethical and correct thing.
I noticed that there's an advisory opinion that's up on the website that is someone asking about, could an employee supervise a relative? That doesn't seem like the hardest question for me as a layperson, but maybe could you explain why that would come to the level of an opinion before your time, but why would that be something that needed a specific legal opinion?
Well, because we have union rules also, collective bargaining rules. There are a lot of different factors that go into it. And, you know, for conflicts of interest, that could present a conflict of interest, but we also have to factor in collective bargaining. So that would rise to the level of an advisory opinion.
So it wouldn't be something that a supervisor could just decide. It would need to be something legal and binding because of all of those other factors.
Because of all those other factors. And so, yes, there's so many factors that go into an ethics opinion. Yes.
Well, speaking of flashy, more than a decade ago, the commission's lead was investigating complaints against former Honolulu Police Chief Louis Kealoha. And the director at that time eventually resigned in protest of the handling of that probe. Times have changed, and you're being perceived as someone who's coming in to be more that watchdog that people see because of your advocacy in the past. How are you looking forward on your job when you know you could get something controversial come your way, or it could be very routine?
Well, I look at this role as a public servant role. Like, this agency, this department is to serve the public good. We are here to restore and to keep the faith in government. And really, that is it. We are here for transparency, for accountability, and to act in accordance with the rule of law. And that is it. Politics will not come into play in this office because we have law, and we will look at our guidance and the rules fairly and equally. And that is it. We will do things transparently, and we will have the public hold us accountable.
You may be familiar to many of our listeners from your role at Common Cause, an organization that advocates for good government. What drew you to this job, and how does it compare from your weeks in the job?
This job holds near and dear to me personally, because this job is supporting good government, is about transparency and accountability. Like I have said, it is not an advocacy role. It is a role in the sense of, how should I put it? It is a role of upholding ethics, rules, and laws, but it is not an advocacy role.
So that's one of the ways it differs. So your previous role for Common Cause was as an advocate for good government. Here, the end result, you would hope, would be good government as well, but you're there to uphold what's there versus advocate for something different.
Correct. You said it better than me. Thank you.
I cheated. You gave me all the tips for it. What are the other things you would wish that our listeners would know about the Ethics Commission and your role going forward? I think sometimes there's still some cynicism out there and stuff. And so I'd like to hear you say, what would you like? Do you have a chance to talk to our listeners directly a little bit? What do you hope people come away with?
Oh, thank you for that. The Honolulu Ethics Commission is staffed by people who deeply understand the ethics laws of Honolulu and are passionate about enforcing the ethics laws and understand the cynicism in the community. And we welcome oversight from the public around the work we do. We do not mind questions. We do not shy away from questions, and we are not afraid of the questions. So please hold us accountable. And if there are concerns that you see in the community, please let us know. And if there's something that is an ethics issue, then we will look at it. You may not like the answer we give you, and that is fine, but we will look at it. A lot of things that you may think is an ethics violation may not actually be an ethics violation. It could be a management decision. It could be a union grievance. it could be a budgetary concern. You may just not like how the city is being run, but that doesn't mean it's an ethics violation. But feel free to contact us. We do care. We are here. We are working. We are investigating.
That was Honolulu Ethics Commission Executive Director Sandy Ma talking about what she's focused on after starting her new role last month. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Later in today's show, we'll be hearing about a change in ownership at one of Honolulu's oldest dive bars and music venues, the intentionally misspelled Anna Bananas. The pub has been in business since 1969, and its name changed from Anna B's to Anna O'Brien's when it came under new management in 2010. Anna's has been home to musical and even culinary innovation for decades. In the 70s, the pub claimed a pineapple peanut butter pizza as its trademark dish. In the 90s, a local ska band sold their first recordings on the sidewalk in front of the bar. The band formed during the third wave ska craze at a bar called The Vibe near UH Manoa. They would go on to tour the U.S. coast to coast and headline a Europe tour across 13 countries. For today's quiz, we want to know, what is the name of this acclaimed ska band? Call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for families of agricultural workers and retirees, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation. NereidHawaii.com.
Harriet Clark was 11 months old when her mother was a getaway driver in the infamous 1981 robbery of a Brinks truck. The robbers were members of radical offshoots of the Weather Underground and the Black Panthers. For the next 37 years, Harriet spent Saturdays visiting her mother in prison. Her new novel is based on that. She's on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Energy's Empower program, helping small businesses with energy solutions. Learn more about this grant program at hawaiienergy.com/empower.
Every other year, the massive Rim of the Pacific makes a splash in the islands as the naval fighting exercise brings ships and troops from across the globe. And while RIMPAC does draw support and protests, this year's exercise displays a greater emphasis on tech. The Honolulu Star Advertiser's Kevin O'Dell is here to explain what's different and why it's significant. Thanks for joining us, Kevin.
Thanks, Robbie.
So tell us a little bit about why technology is taking a bigger role on the stage this year.
Well, this grows on iterations that we've seen in the past. The first time I personally saw it was in the last iteration where they were displaying what they've been doing with 3D printing, their ability to make spare parts for ships on the fly. And in the months and years since, we've seen units in Hawaii kind of build upon that to the point where they're building their own operational drones in the field and doing all kinds of things with this manufacturing capability.
So that's not that's something that's already being used in the field as well as in the exercises.
It is, but what they're saying right now is that this is the largest what they're calling advanced manufacturing event that they've done so far throughout the Department of Defense. So it's at a much larger scale. They've been using drones to deliver parts to ships out there. Specifically, they did the first waterborne, like a drone boat delivered supplies to the USS Essex. And the boat itself is from a company called Splash Industries, I believe it was, out of Los Angeles, was steered entirely autonomously, which meant that the onboard software got it where it needed to go. They told it where they wanted it to get to, but it figured it out using its own onboard software.
So that's important on a larger scale because it puts fewer humans at risk when the tech can get there?
Well, in theory. I mean, it puts fewer humans at risk, but it also means that if they lose one of these boats, they can build another one. It's easier to build some of this stuff on demand. And in the past, you know, these parts that we're talking about, it could take weeks, months, even years to get spare parts, depending on how rare it is, what company it's coming from, where it's being produced, and getting things all the way out here to Hawaii, or if they're operating somewhere forward in the Pacific, like Japan or the Philippines, it's just not a guarantee that you can get that stuff easily. And now they can do it within hours.
Yeah, I mean, for sure, we've all written those infamous stories about a part that cost a small part that cost a lot of money and is hard to get. So this is definitely a step forward if they can do it on the fly while they're deployed. One of the things you wanted you working on today, sadly, is another related story about drones.
Well, yeah, our understanding is the most recent Iranian attack on U.S. forces in Iran, which the Pentagon is currently describing as a missile and drone attack. One of the dead was First Lieutenant Tyler Feehan of Eva Beach. And it kind of demonstrates how dangerous a lot of this equipment is. This exercise is kind of – they're showing the proliferation of low-cost drones, low-cost weapons, and Iranian forces have been using this to very deadly effect in the Middle East. This technology that we're seeing here, it's not really sci-fi. This is stuff that we've already seen. You know, U.S. forces are starting to use it in the Pacific, but it's really based on what we've seen on battlefields in Ukraine, battlefields in the Middle East. And this is actually in many ways something that U.S. military commanders are catching up to in terms of a reality of what the new landscape is.
Were there any tech surprises for what you've learned so far this year from RIMPAC?
I mean, the autonomous boat delivery was interesting. It's not a shock. We've known that this technology is around. It's just kind of – it's a large iteration, and it's not entirely surprising. Admiral Paparo, the commander of U.S. forces in the Pacific, has been a big booster of using this technology, bringing more of it into Hawaii and bringing more of it into the islands. But, you know, again, what we've seen in the Middle East over the weekend is a reminder that this technology has very real consequences.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that technology update and sadly for also updating us on what the ultimate cost of war can be.
Thank you, Robbie.
Thanks, Kevin. Now it's time to reveal the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we shared some of the storied history of local dive bar Anna O'Brien's, which many may remember as Anna Bananas. The upstairs venue space has long nurtured up-and-coming local talent. We told you about a homegrown ska band that sold its very first recordings on cassette tape outside of Anna's in 1997. And Our winner of the backyard quiz is Ray from Kauai, and he knew that the band would later fly the coop, tour the continental United States and abroad. A 2004 article in the Honolulu Advertiser polled readers on whether they thought the band would become the mighty, mighty Boss Tones or whether they'd be back playing Oahu by the end of the year. Ray knew the truth, but the group did see continued success across the U.S., Europe, and Asia throughout the aughts. In 2016, the band celebrated its 20th anniversary and played a farewell show at the Republic in Honolulu. We asked you to name this mystery ska band. We're looking for Go Jimmy Go. Thanks again to Ray from Kauai for giving us that answer. That's today's quiz. If you've got an idea for our quiz, tell us about it at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Bill Comerford's been planning his Irish goodbye for years. Comerford has spent his life in bars and has owned many of Oahu's Irish pubs in a career stretching nearly three decades here. Recently, he sold one of these mainstay bars to new owners. You may know it as Anna Bananas, Anna O'Brien's, or simply just Anna's. HBR's Kevin Allen visited Comerford's last remaining pub, the Irish Rose, and he spoke with a local legend about his view from behind the bar.
Often I was babysitting the bar with a roll of nickels, where you put half the roll into the pinball machine, half into the jukebox, and my dad would say, play some Irish songs and play some Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, everything like that. And that's how I was raised, you know, from the time I was like 7, 8 years old.
You know. Did you always know that you wanted to work in the bars?
Believe it or not, when I was a kid, I thought I was going to be a priest. Didn't work that way.
You know. I don't believe it.
And went through school, you know, went to college in Central Connecticut State, and did well. I was a history major, and I had the aspect of graduating and teaching history. And I said, you're going to teach history to high school kids or junior high kids that have no concern for you, don't want to hear it, and say, we want to get out of this room. That's all we want. So I said, it's kind of frustrating that way. So I didn't have the patience then, so I moved into restaurant management, and I had a job immediately because I'd been working in bars since I was a kid. So my first job was 12 years old, sweeping out bars. Yeah.
And I think it's so interesting too. I mean, like, it's funny to me that in one night at a bar, you can see almost everything. You can see people fight, you can see people love, and sometimes you see both at the same time, and it's really confusing. But you've been in bars for decades at this point. Just tell me about some of the craziest things you've seen, or just what you've seen. And
well, what you'll see in a bar, and this is people don't understand this. A bar or a pub, more likely a pub, it's a gathering place for the neighborhood. In other words, it's a community center. It's all those other things. Provides entertainment. You have the chance to meet your friends without having to have them come over and spill beer all over your living room table, right? Instead, it's a place they can come in, behave, have a great time and leave, come back, and you meet all your friends. You know? And there's a huge group of friends in here. But I also have entertainment. It makes it so that people come out, and people, they want to have a good time. We want people to have a good time. But to have a good time, they have to behave. And when their behavior interferes on somebody else's behavior, time to change the behavior. Doesn't mean you have to go home. Doesn't mean you can't ever come back. It's change your behavior. Move to the other side of the room. Don't be bothering these people. Separate. So it's training people over time as repeat customers to come in and enjoy it. I have remarkably few incidents in here. You do, because you're going to have people that are not your norms, and they'll walk in and they have different expectations. But people find that the bar is comfortable, they come back. And that's the whole focus of everybody in a bar. You want repeat customers.
And I feel like I've always gone to Anna's because to me it's just felt incredibly comfortable. Like you were saying, it kind of feels like this home away from home. I can talk to the bartenders and talk to regulars, and it's always comfortable for me. And I think there's a certain comfort that it also comes with Irish bars in particular, where I feel like there's similarities between, I think, the familiarity you see with Irish bars as well as just kind of being in Hawaii and, you know, seeing people that you know and feeling very warm and comfortable with people. Can you speak to that?
Let's go this route and say a lot of people always say, well, Hawaii and Ireland are often alike. Why? They're both islands. They're both tribal kingdoms. And they are similar. Not identical, but similar. So you can often see the similarities in that. You know, Ireland has a great sense of welcoming. In Hawaii, we have, you know, aloha. Over there, it's 100,000 welcomes. They always have a welcome on the mat, you know, and that's what you'll always find if you go to Ireland. And I think the people here are the same way, you know. So that's a similarity in culture, and I think it's a wonderful thing. It's surprising how many people in Hawaii have some Irish roots, you know. Yeah. I think you came here because of Tavana's announcement, and, you know, Tavana's last name is McMoore, so he's got a bit of Irish in him as well.
Something I've always really loved about all of your establishments is that every single time I come in, and you're just talking about it, there's live music happening. There's almost always a show every single night at Anna's or the Rose. I mean, I've played here with my band a handful of times, and it's always a great experience. But can you, you talk to me a little bit about why having live music is so important, not even just for the establishments and for the listeners, but also just for the bands and just kind of keeping this musicality going throughout the islands, something that I feel like we're just really known for.
The most important thing is for musicians is to have a place to play. And that's always the hard part. They can do weddings, they can do different things, but they don't get, gigs enough to stay active. So with live music in bars, it keeps the music scene active all the time. Bands get formed around different things all the time. We have key bands that, over time that we've had that were remarkable. The Piranha Brothers, Elephant, the Kai Roots right now, and a long history of great bands. And what do? They occupy the room, and people come to see them. Repeats. And with COVID, they did something very sad where they closed the bars. They told people they couldn't sing, couldn't dance, couldn't be next to each other. And the whole time that happened, we turned our whole industry of hospitality into the hostility business.
That's something I wanted to touch on, too. And, you know, I know that a lot of people, they see COVID as a thing that we've recovered from. But I think for a lot of people in the hospitality industry, there was no recovery. It was the death nail. Can you speak to that? As you know, you owned O'Toole's Irish Pub, Kelly O'Neill's, Anna O'Brien's, and the Irish Rose Saloon prior to 2020.
Well, we do a fiscal year, which is in line with a liquor license. So the prior year, we did $6.5 million. So the year that started in June of 2020, we did $65,000. We went from $6.5 million to $65,000. I don't own my buildings. I rent them. I have an operative business. I'm paying the taxes. I'm paying the rent. I'm paying the utilities. I'm paying all the benefits for all my employees. And all that stuff. When you have no income, you have nothing. And government didn't even talk to us, would not even talk to us. I'm sad to say this, but I was blackballed by the government. And that's real. People say, no, it's real. They're still penalizing me. I've been audited by the Liquor Commission, by the Health Department, by the Labor Department, and also by the Tax Department. It never ends. They just, you spoke up and you weren't allowed to speak. Don't rock the boat. I'm sorry, my boat is sunk, I'm underwater, I'm just asking questions. When can we open? And they wouldn't answer. But the sad thing was that in that same time period, I had 83 employees, and I paid people profit sharing, I paid care of their health care. People were proud to work for me, and they were very happy with it. When they destroyed all this, I could not bring people back because they knew I was $1 million in debt. Didn't have the means to open for another year and a half when I got the Federal Restaurant Relief Fund. And that allowed us to reopen, but first off, you had to pay $1.5 million in debt, try to organize and start all over. Who wants to start over at 67 years old? I'm trying to retire. I was supposed to be selling the bars and walking away. Well, the sad thing was they also took away the value of the bars. All of a sudden, the bars, you can't operate it. I went to the laughable Board of Economic Revitalization. It's a city and county board. And I said, what should I do? They said, borrow $1 million. I said, are you economic advisors or are you government? Because guess what? No bank is going to loan me when I have no income, $1 million debt, and you can't tell me when my business can open. There's no prospects for getting a loan there. They said, then you should sell them. I said, who's going to buy a bar that they can't get a loan, can't operate, and nobody's going to buy it. The bars have no value. Yeah. None. Yeah.
And you've been slowly retiring.
I'm the boy who calls wolf. I try to retire, and the complications of trying to transfer a license or get somebody to purchase a thing has just been a failure, truly. I got taken by two guys that claimed they were, you know, going to buy my bar. They put $40,000 down, walked away with all my inventory and 9 month sales, and I got nothing out of it. I had to take the bar back. That was over at Anna's.
Yeah. But you're kind of getting at, I mean, it does seem like you're retiring now. I've heard you say, I've heard Bill is retiring for like 5 years of my life at this point, but.
I've been trying. Yeah. I've had my, I think a year and a half ago, I had my going away party.
Does it feel like you're retiring now, though?
No. I'm trying to get out of the business because I have so much else I have to do just in life. Mm. Once upon a time, I was 27 when I got here. I'm now, I'll be 74 in October. It's like, you run out of time, Bill, to do the other things you want to do. Sure. And have family elsewhere. I mean, sadly, my family was raised here, my son and his grandchildren, but they've moved to Oregon because of the cost of living as well. So that's where I'm probably heading myself, up in that way. You know, so.
How does it feel, kind of looking back at the past 30 years here, working in the industry and thinking about leaving?
It's sad in the fact that I had a good time doing this. I'm fortunate in the fact that I had a good life. I've had struggles. I've gone through some hard times. We went through 9/11. I had 3 bars on Lewis Street, and I had 2 homes to pay for. On the, 9/11, everything was rosy on 9/10. 9/11, everything changed, and we had no tourists. On October 1st, I owed $55,000 in rents and mortgages with no income coming in. And you go, what's going on? You know? But I lived through it, and I've lived through other things. But I'm going to say this, that my partner and I, when we got into the business, we were on Lewis Street with Irish Rose. Irish Rose is doing 5 nights of rock and roll and 2 nights of folk. And I said, well, we're going to open the Kelly O'Neill's 200 yards away. And I said, let's do alternative rock over there, and we'll do alt rock and roll here. And it was a good change, and people went back and forth. So it didn't hurt us. But my partner has always decided, I can't deal with the musicians. So I've been the one that's dealt with the schedules and putting people together and keeping bands and making bands happen and stuff. So I've enjoyed it. And when people say, Bill, do you play an instrument? I say, I'm lucky enough to have a good ear, but I don't play any instruments. I play the stereo, and I kind of date myself by saying so. You know? Yeah, but I do miss it. I will not go out to say any one band was better than others. There was great bands here, truly. What I'm going to miss is the ability to bring Irish bands over here. Because Irish bands can't make it to just show up here, but when you had 4 bars that could let them perform in the 4 different bars, that could work, you know?
If someone wanted to buy a bar right now and get into the business themselves, what would you say to them?
Let me just say, I may not own bars now as I get out, but I will be a consultant, and I'll charge you a $5,000 consultant fee to help you get a bar open and direct you in different ways. But the first thing I would say is, I want $1,000 cash, and I'm going to take that cash and I'm going to turn around to you and say, don't do it.
That was HBR's Kevin Allen speaking with colorful veteran bar owner Bill Comerford. We wish Bill all the best on really retiring this time. We'll also be speaking with Anna O'Brien's new owner, Tavana, this week, so stay tuned. That's it for today. Tomorrow, we hear an unfortunate update about our native birds on Kauai. Populations of honeycreepers have plummeted since the fall. What stories would you like us to do? Give us a call on our talkback line at 808-792-8217. Did you know you can find The Conversation as a podcast? It's on our app, website, and on Spotify or Apple. Thanks for joining us. I'm Robbie Dingman. Catherine Cruz will be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.